Oh, look at all these motherfucking racists.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Molly Glover, Nick Glover, and Tim Wick.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks. Geeks Without God.
This week on Geeks Without God, our guest is Joseph Scrimshaw. He's joined us before, and now he has a brand new movie, Dead Media. We were at the premiere, and we talked with Joseph in spoiler-free manner about making the movie.
We're geeks without God.
Welcome to Geeks Without God. I'm your host, Molly Glover, joined as always by my co-hosts, Nick Glover.
Hey.
And Tim Wick.
Hi, that's me, Tim Wick.
And as always, we are nailing the intro.
Yeah, you got it.
We are joined today by a longtime friend and guest of the show, Joseph Scrimshaw. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, Joseph. Hello, I am happy to be here, and I want to nail the intro with you guys.
Thank you.
Perfect. It was flawless.
Did it. Yeah, thank you.
Did it, everybody. We're here to talk about Joseph's amazing movie, Dead Media. You directed a whole goddamn movie, a feature-length film in the parlance of the day.
And wrote it and produced it. You were in it. You were in it. You had a role in the movie, too. Not the star,
He Hitchcocked himself right in.
You saw a space where there wasn't a movie and just did all the things to make that space occupied by a movie.
I saw a small space to try not to pay another actor. And then SAG made me pay myself anyway.
Those bastards. So I want to back up just a little bit because you are born and raised here, right? Is that correct? In Minnesota, Twin Cities?
Yep.
Basically. And so I met you, and I know Nick met you at the same time, but as a Twin Cities theater darling, as it were, I would say your name was as much as Minneapolis has comedy stars. I feel like you were one of those stars. And then you moved to LA to pursue writing and directing. And so give us just a little bit of backstory for our readers of how that's gone. I mean, you moved to LA 10 years ago.
Yeah, a little over 10 years, yeah.
And was it, do you feel like it, did it take a while? Everyone, you know, there's that old adage of, it's impossible to get into anything there. Like, what work did you do before you found yourself able to make this incredible accomplishment?
Yeah, I think the LA part is a mixed bag because I moved here when I was a little bit older and a lot of things do happen through friend groups. At one point, my writing manager was like, can you please just make some more friends? Because that's how people get jobs. Like, everybody likes your writing, but it can be harder to hire people because everybody hires their buddies that they grew up with.
Sure.
So there's definitely some of that bouncing around. I had some good experiences. A friend hired me on the Adult Swim show Tig Tone.
Yes.
Really fun, really good, until it got Zaslav'd and taken off of HBO Max for credits. So anyway, I had a lot of good experiences writing and a lot of good experiences pitching, in particular pitching movies and television shows, and had some like really close calls to things coming through. Mm-hmm. But then it got really frustrating that all of these scripts existed, came close to getting made, but then didn't get made. And I have so many writing friends, I'd read their scripts and they came close to getting made, but then they wouldn't get made. And I just kind of had a moment where I felt like, well, I think I've really leveled up in terms of writing for screen. I think I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
And hey, the way I found any success in the Twin Cities was producing my own work. You know, I was not a critical darling of getting grants or auditioning at the Guthrie. I made my way up through Fringe and Convergence and places where I could just get myself in front of an audience.
Yeah.
So I had taken enough break from producing where I was like, you know how I started out and I wanted to do a show and then I just rented a theater and I hired people and it was scary and took a lot of money and time and it hurt, but then it was good. Why don't I do that for a movie?
Yeah, that's awesome. When you pitch things, do they belong to the studio you pitch them to or are they still your creative property? I know that like for game design, it's really hard because if you pitch something to a game studio, if they even pretend to make it for a little while and then stop, that's now their idea. And that,
wow.
So I wasn't sure how that worked with Hollywood.
I think every industry is evil in its own way. I think if they like buy it and say we're going to make it and they develop it and then they like cancel it or they make a pilot, sure. I think there can
you
be
sign
different kinds
something
of rights
that
issues.
Says they own it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, or they'll, you know, own it for they'll have an option on it for a while. And sure. If you have a bad contract, they could be like, "We optioned this for 10 years and we have no intention of making it. We just wanted to gobble it up."
So was Dead Media inspired by any of those previous pitches, or was this just a whole new brand new idea out of all these other ideas that you have been throwing against the wall to frustration?
Yeah, so I should also say, like, in the build up to this, I decided to try to make a couple short films, and I made some ones for fun on my iPhone, and then I did a Kickstarter for like a 20-minute horror film.
The Nightmare Adorable. Yeah.
The Nightmare Adorable. Yeah, that went and that did really well and played at like 20 festivals and won a couple of awards. So that was one of the things that that made me feel like, yeah, I can do that. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of in the process of brainstorming short story ideas, short film ideas for horror, where I remembered in the late 90s, early 2000s, when DVDs were so exciting and fresh. And also a lot of VHS found horror was happening at the same time.
Yeah,
that was kind of funny to have this contrast where, like, you find a VHS in a cabin, you have no idea what could be on there, and it's so creepy. And then this sort of shiny new wrapped thing of, like, that's digital, and I bought it at Best Buy, and there was, like, at the time, nothing scary about DVDs. And I remember thinking that was funny. And then it's like, so much time has passed, and now DVDs are old, and anything old starts to become haunted.
Creepy. And
thinking about that idea of Easter eggs and that idea of like, yay, we put something on there that you're kind of not supposed to find, and sometimes it'll just be like an actor farting or whatever, but other times it'll be something kind of like weird and deviant. And that was kind of the starting point of the idea of DVD horror.
That's really cool. Did you immediately decide that you wanted to make this in Minnesota, or was there any point when you were thinking you would try to make it somewhere else?
No, I always wanted to make it in Minnesota because I think as I started to think about the idea, it started to become a horror of DVD, but also the horror of feeling trapped in the past. And I think the more I thought about it, I was reliving my own past and where was I at and where were all my friends at in 1999 and how has that changed and how hasn't that changed? So I think it on an emotional level, it always felt like a Minneapolis story. Mm-hmm. And then when I thought about how to practically do it, it's like, what if I filmed it at my dad's house for no money?
Did you tell your dad it's because you wanted the movie to really feel trapped in the past and that's why you wanted to use his house?
No, it was the ending up at my dad's house is just like I needed to picture a house to write it because a lot of it happens in the house and a lot of it is about traffic in a house. So it's just like I got to picture a house. I'm going to picture my dad's house. And I honestly didn't think he would ever want it because he's a real neat freak. And I was visiting, and he made me hot dogs that he put in a wrap, not a bun, because he's on a low-carb diet. And we're eating, and he's like, tell me more about this movie. He's like, well, so I wrote it, you know, I had to write it for a house, so I wrote it for your house. And he stopped eating his hot dog and thought about it, and he's like, you can film it here if you want.
Oh,
so it was like a real nice emotional moment.
That's so nice. Yeah, it's important, I think, that picturing a house you know, because like I've read horror books where they're describing a house that is impossible. And that's not that's not the plot either. Like that's just like it's like, how are you in the bathroom? The kitchen was off to the right before and now the bathroom's to the right. Like
the cosmic horror house.
Yeah.
the Minneapolis-ness of this in movie, especially in that time period, right? The late 90s. I was going to high school in Minneapolis. I lived in Whittier in 98, 99, and so like just east of Uptown. So there's so much of this that was very nostalgic for me in a way that was also felt like a little bit of a I don't want to say like a call out, but like I definitely view like that time period in that area holds a very special place for me. And maybe that's because of the age I was when I was there or whatever, but it's changed so dramatically over the years from what it was then that I definitely like kind of lament and long for that time and place. And so in this movie, I was like nostalgic for it and also a little bit called out like in a good way.
A lot of the actors are beloved actors and comedians we know from, you know, locally, you know, Bill Corbett and Shannon Custer, Sam Landman. But there were some actors I didn't know who I don't think live here. And how did you get in touch with them? Did you have a casting call? Did you hold some kind of open auditions for some of these roles, or did you have a casting director who knew people?
Yeah. So, the couple of people who are not from the Twin Cities, James Urbaniak, who people know from The Venture mm-hmm. Brothers or a million different things, everything from Oppenheimer to he gets beat up by Agent Carter in season 2, I believe, of Agent Carter. He's in one of everything. Great actor. I had met him and become friends with him in L.A. So that was just a direct ask. And then I had to deal with his agents and all
a
that.
A friend you made at your writing manager's request.
There you go. Yes. It's about time.
Hurry up. James, give me more writing jobs. and then the woman who plays the lead, Maggie, was a contact through the director, Joe Lynch, who is an executive producer on the film. And he consulted and read the script and gave some feedback and things like that. And he suggested her. Everybody, those are the two people who are from L.A. Everybody else, I had this totally cocky idea of like, okay, when I wrote it, I pictured Sam Landman in this lead role. I pictured Anna Sundberg, who I knew from the Twin Cities, who has since mm-hmm. moved to New York, but I pictured her in this really important role. And I had this cocky idea of, like, it's going to be so easy to cast this movie because I know all these theater actors. And then it's like, wait, I wrote a bunch of 20-somethings, and the youngest person I know in Minnesota is 37 years old. So I asked a bunch of friends, older friends in Minnesota, for recommendations of younger actors, and I did just have a casting call by myself in a studio, and yeah, found some really, really, really great Twin Cities actors, 20, 25 years old.
Yeah, the actors, I was really blown away by the performances in this movie. They really, absolutely brought a lot of heart to a horror movie, which is really important. I think people miss that a lot, and they don't realize how important it is to have other emotions than just I'm afraid in your actors.
Yes.
It was really good. It was really good.
Yeah. Well, I was actually talking to Sarah, Joseph's wife, after the movie, and I was like, I cared about these characters enough that I cared whether or not they made it, which I think is really important for horror. If I don't give a damn about your characters, then I'm pretty much bored. I'm like, yeah. Please, yeah. Can you just kill them? Because I'm done with them.
And then it becomes, and I do think there is a genre of horror where a part of the fun is sort of just like the inventiveness of the kill, and maybe sometimes people want almost a little emotional distance from the characters. But I really love films where, yes, you care about the characters. The monsters and the horror is sort of reflective of what's going on with the characters, and you really don't want them to die.
Yeah.
I think that Scream is one of my favorite films and franchises, and I think people, especially in 96, you know, when it came out and it was this a revelation, people talk so much about the meta-ness and the comedy, but I feel like the secret sauce is, like, there's, like, just these long, mournful shots of Sidney Prescott's soulful eyes, and you give a damn about her, you know? It's like, that's the magic.
Colossally fucked up
in
a lot of ways. And it's like, you can see how it's affecting, you know, what should be like an ordinary and kind of boring life.
So we do a lot of, you know, movie reviews. I just want to let everyone know, we're not really reviewing this movie so much because we don't want to spoil it. We always joke about how if we're going to talk about a movie, there's spoilers. We don't usually get to have the director on the show and the writer. So I really do want to focus more on process. When you first wrote this down, did you write an outline? Did you write short story? I know you write a lot of fiction, but you've also written a lot of like plays and, you know, kinds of things. So how did you attack the idea? Once you had the idea and you knew what you wanted to do, did you just straight up launch into a screenplay, you know, interior house, or did you actually plot it out differently?
Yeah, I think going through the process, like, this is the seventh screenplay that I've written, and a lot of those screenplays I went back and forth with my manager and with friends' groups, and so a lot of that discussion is about process. So, and I and everybody likes to give writing advice about the process, and I think the process is the one that works for each individual writer. Mm-hmm. And this script came together really, really well for me just listening to myself about what my process is. Mm. And an ideal process for me is knowing the what. If you know, like, this is what the film is about, this is the, like, inciting incident, this is maybe a twist that happens in the middle, and this is how it ends. This is the emotional point of how it ends. This is where the main characters need to end up. If you know the what, then I think a lot of the writing process is the how, and the how is much more flexible than the what. So I had kind of an outline of the first act, and then I knew those really important what beats. Like, I always knew what I was writing toward. And that, for me, is like the perfect balance, because then you don't get overly pedantic with an outline of just filling it in. And it gives you a little bit of room to discover things as you're writing. So, yeah, my wife, I knew I wanted to write this. I knew I wanted to make this as a film as soon as possible. And my wife was out of town for 5 days. And I just said, I have 5 days to write the first draft. And parts of the first draft didn't suck. That's fine. As long as, like, the heart of the thing is there. And that really helped to just write it fast.
I just imagine Sarah coming home to like 17 empty martini glasses, pizza boxes, you in a bathrobe, your hair sticking all up, and you're like, I did it! I did it, Sarah! And she's like, did what?
I think she did this a couple times when she's left. She pre-mixed me like a mason jar of martini.
See, now that's a good wife. That's a great wife.
That's a nice wife. I know she taught me how to make my own martinis now, so I don't need mason jars, but she's even done that wife. In the past.
Yeah. Teach a man to fish.
It's
scientifically proven that a sandwich you make and a sandwich someone makes for you, the one made for you tastes better of the preparation. The
cocktail.
The
care,
yeah.
It's, yes.
Perfect sense.
Own martinis, they're better. That's good to know. Maybe if I made my own martinis, I would like them. Not sure.
Probably not.
I actually have a question for you, Joseph. Partially processed, but your history has been mostly comedy. But I'm noticing in the last several years, you've sort of moved towards horror. And what was the why did that happen? Why did you make the decision to move that direction? What was the inspiration or whatever?
It wasn't really an idea. It was just sort of a mood, I think. I like genre, and I like horror, and it just every idea I came up with started to be horror. And I think a part of that is I absolutely love comedy, but I feel like every time I talk to people about comedy in LA in particular, I think this happens everywhere, but in LA in particular, there's a real like, oh, so like people get hit in the head with things and they fart, right? And like a real sense, like as soon as you say comedy, it's like turn off your brain and have a good time. And like people kind of mean that in a positive way. And I'm like, no, never.
Yeah.
Comedy is about ideas, even very base comedy that is like, you know, silent films. That's like, it's, you know, existential dread. It's the struggle of life. It's Laurel and Hardy can't get up and walk through a door without 8 million challenges. It's the struggle of life. Like, that's the way I look at comedy. And I know that's the way that a lot of people like you guys look at comedy. Even when it's quote unquote comedy for fun, there's always meaning, there's always heart. So, and I think being around that expectation of comedy so much made me feel like, well, I want to use a different noun, and it can have as much comedy in it
sure
as it does, but I want to start from this place of like, no, there'll be jokes, and you know, maybe somebody will get hit on the head, but also I'm gonna fucking kill people in this. So maybe take it seriously.
I feel like comedy and horror are both transgressive, right? In a certain way. They both kind of use a lot of like subverting expectations and norms to get the laugh or to get the fear, yep. Right? Mm-hmm. And so I comedy horror as a genre I absolutely love. Those are my two of my favorite things, right? It's a you got your chocolate and my peanut butter situation.
Well, and two, I think, you know, with comedy, both comedy and horror, you have an audience that is set up to be a little adversarial. People come to a comedy show and they're like, okay, make me laugh. They go to a horror movie to be like, sure, let's see if this is scary. And you, so you're starting from that position of adversary with your audience where it's like, no, listen, I'm gonna get you, and you're not gonna expect it, and it's gonna happen. But you know, I think that's why reviews can be so polarizing of both comedy and horror, where it's like people be like, "This was trash. It didn't scare me at all." And it's like, but okay, but that's, you know, I've seen, we get that with books a lot. Like, this wasn't even a horror book. It wasn't scary. And it's like, well, that you don't get to decide that it's not a horror movie just because it didn't scare you. Just like you don't get to decide it's not a comedy just because it wasn't funny to you. And I think that's, you don't get that with drama. No one comes out of a drama and goes, that wasn't even sad. Like, I didn't even care. Oh, the war, big deal. You know, like,
but couldn't make me cry.
But you get that with comedy and with horror. And I think that it makes a lot of sense to me that we see both comedians, you know, making horror and people who start in horror going into comedy. I mean, it's, and there's a lot of overlap there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think, yeah, I think on that functional level, like Nick was saying, it is the setup and release of catharsis is there on a functional level. And I think comedy and horror both deep down in their heart have this sort of like, let's be honest that there's awful things in the world. Now, how are we going to face them? In particular, I think horror that cares about the characters is like, okay, well, this awful thing is going to be in their face. How are they going to deal with it?
For sure.
Yeah, I think I've been writing more horror in the last few years too, and I'd like to believe it's because there was a pandemic and everything's terrible. But I think also there's a recognition that I've had for a while that horror and comedy are almost the same story, and it's just a question of which direction you take it, right? That the setup is almost the same, and then it's, are you going to take it in a really terrible direction, or are you going to take it in an amusing direction? So I've found that as I've written, if I like just kind of go, well, what happens if this isn't bright? What happens if it's dark? The same story can turn in a different way. And I think that when you start from a place of comedy, if comedy is where you started, going to horror is easier than I thought it would be. If I'm honest, it was like, well, this is actually really similar to what I was going to write anyway. I'm just not going to have it end with a joke. I'm going to have it end with a oh shit moment instead. So
yeah, so, I love that what you're saying of just like it's almost like a different result, like picturing Laurel and Hardy like, okay, yeah, well, what if they fell down the stairs with the piano?
Yeah.
And they
and
died.
Laurel's shin bone is sticking out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now one of them has to hide a body.
Yeah. So, yeah. The filming, so you know, you've written it, you've got your screenplay, you've got your cast, the actual filming, how long did it take for you to film the movie from start to finish?
So it was very, very fast. the other big part of this was, you know, raising money, which was mostly, in from investors. So, as fellow Minnesotans, you can imagine the thrill of,
love that.
Emailing
love
any friend
about money.
You know, who asking, might have a really good job and go, hey, would you give me thousands of dollars? Yeah. That was a really fun part of the process. But we had a really, really tight budget. We had to do it for as little money as humanly possible. So the main shoot was 14 days.
That's fast.
It's very fast, yeah. And then we ended up having, I did 2 days of pickup shoots in June. We shot it in November, December 2024 and did 2 days, a day and a half, really, of pickup shoots. But the speed of shooting it was the hardest thing in the entire process because, you know, I felt the responsibility to make sure that everything was getting done and people were still leaving on time.
Yep.
Lots of hard choices about, like, which scene to spend more time on. And did I get that shot that I absolutely need? I think so. I'll find out when I edit because we got to move on.
Was your dad and maybe others living in the house during the 14-day shoot?
My dad came home late at night after the shooting was done. I told him what time...
I'm just picturing like having to make sure everything's consistent and that like all your shots stay set up, but also having a neat freak dad who comes home and is like has to not put anything away.
There was one good bonding moment because a lot of people on the crew, we had a really great script supervisor, but he was a little bit overwhelmed. So other people on the crew were really cool about like the makeup artist, both the real makeup artist, the human makeup artist, and the monster makeup artist, were really helpful with continuity. And there was one thing that was kind of in deep background, which was this old mug from the 80s that had a cat on it that I randomly put out to make the home messy because the home was supposed to be messy. And the cat mug kept getting moved. And there's the makeup artist who kept noticing, like, where'd that goddamn cat mug go? So, like, on maybe, like, the third day of shooting at my dad's house, I discovered that for some reason he kept putting the cat mug away. And, like, Dad, the cat mug is part of the set.
Was it your dad's cat mug or is...
I don't know. I don't know why that thing...
He's like, this couldn't possibly be in the movie.
It's like, and I had crap everywhere. He was very patient with what a mess it was.
What did you use for craft services? Did you provide or did you use a local restaurant?
we made a deal with two of my favorite restaurants that I had emotional attachment to, of Leaning Tower and Bryant Lake Bowl.
Nice. Yep.
I wanted to put them in the movie anyway. But I said, hey, if we put you prominently in the film, will you do some of the craft services? So they gave us each several meals. And
that's
then
great.
Other than that, it was just like going to random restaurants.
Costco.
We should have done Costco.
That's great. A little bit of talk about the movie. We saw the premiere at the Parkway, thank you.
Like,
I get Riverview and Parkway. The Parkway Theater. It was really fun. A lot of our friends were there, which was great to see. But also, the movie's really good. it's a lot of fun. One of my favorite things about it is the creepy monster effect you do that I'm not going to describe. But it's very simple. And it's very effective. And I I don't have nightmares about things I watch, but I've definitely had like feelings of dread that I can be like, that I'm picturing it again. And like, oh God, it was so creepy. Really like, because I feel like low budget tends to come across as being cheap, but there are effective ways to do things. And I feel like this was extremely effective in terms of upping the absolute fucking creepy factor.
Well, that is very great to hear. I'm a big believer in artists really just trying to ask themselves, what do I want it to feel like? Now, what possible tool do I have at my hands to make it feel the way I'm feeling? And I do think that sometimes there's a desire to just, if you're making an indie film or your first films, to try to make it look like other films. And like, cool. You might have a budget, but like the important thing is to make it feel like you, make it feel like you want it to feel.
Yeah, I think that. So, do you find? I mean, are you a big horror movie person? Like, is that something? Is it a genre you enjoy to watching?
Oh yeah, no. The last two Octobers have been frustrating because I've been working on this horror film, so I haven't had as much time to watch horror films as I want to.
Were there any films or books that you kind of had in your, you know, in your head as, or like not necessarily inspiration, but things that you felt like you wanted to, you're like, I want to draw on the way that made me feel, or I want to, you know, there's a bit here that's a little bit of a nod or a tone. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, like I said, in terms of emotion, Scream is a big thing. And I think just in the way some of that is shot in terms of spending time on characters' faces. This is not a horror. Well, there's some scary moments, but not a horror film. Empire Strikes Back. I have an opinion that one of the things about that film that makes it so successful is Irvin Kershner, the director, lingered on people's faces and just let us feel what they're feeling.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of close shots like that in Dead.
A lot of close shots. Yeah, there's that little scene where Luke is getting ready to leave for the Battle of Hoth and is trying to find the right thing to say goodbye or good luck to Han Solo, and neither of them can quite find the right thing to say, and he leaves, and then a shot just lingers for maybe 2 seconds, maybe a second and a half, on Han's face looking like, my friend might fucking die.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing that I thought about a lot, of just like faces. I'm a big David Lynch fan, and I think that his stuff definitely can veer into horror, but his stuff is also just like, he's such a proponent of just follow the feeling and the mood, and don't question it. If it feels like the camera should be slowly pushing in, just follow that feeling. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I really, a mantra that, you know, I had while we were filming is just like, just follow the feeling. Just tell the story. Make sure that the characters are feeling what they're supposed to be feeling, that I know in my gut. And if it's supposed to be scary, make sure it feels scary.
I think for writer-director horror, that is something that I love. Writer-director horror films, particularly. even if they're not great, at least I know that I'm seeing the intended vision, especially if they happen to be a producer on it, right? But like, it is, to me, that is, you know, you're really seeing, you know, what they wanted you to see, and I really felt that with Dead Media. I felt like I could almost read your script, if that makes sense. Like, it really came through in the movie. I'm curious, did you take like classes in LA about like film director? Did you go to film school? Like, what, or is this all just sort of a gut self-taught guy who loves movies kind of a thing?
I think far more gut. And I think part of it is having a visual arts background, because I went to college, University of Minnesota, and got a visual art degree. Mm-hmm. And I think that having a sense of framing, just literally composing, and then also having a sense of movement. And I'm not the greatest musician in the world, but I'm a drummer. And I think there's also like a sense from music of, what is the rhythm? What is the build? And you guys all know this from live comedy too. I mean, nothing mm-hmm. teaches you rhythm like live comedy. Of like, last night I had to drop this joke two beats earlier than I normally do, because that's what the audience needs. You know, like, so I think for me, like, a lot of bits and pieces of filmmaking can be learned from other life experiences, you know?
Yeah. I this is going to sound like damning with faint praise. I assure you, it is extreme praise. I left and was like, that looked like a fucking movie. Like, I've seen people make movies who I know, and then I've watched it and been like, okay. But like, this looked like a real fucking movie, Joseph. Like, it was the shots, the lighting, the editing, the film quality. Like, it genuinely, there was no part of me that was like, oh, I'm seeing something amateur. I'm seeing something that was produced small. Truly, that is high praise for me. I am very critical of that kind of thing. And it was really gorgeous.
I'm very, very happy to hear that. Yes. In the team that I work with, the cinematographers, I met on Nightmare Adorable. So I had worked with him before. And the makeup artist, Claire, also ended up doing the color work, all the color grading, which affects a lot the quality of the film. There's a lot, a lot of choices in how it actually looks and feels emotionally. I think kind of I learned a lot about undersung heroes. There's a gentleman named Joel who came, Matthias, he was a pal of Matthias, the cinematographer, and came in, and you watch the credits and it's B-cam operator. But a ton of the beautiful shots are, this guy's is just like, he's just like, I don't have any opinions other than I love film. So tell me whatever you want to see. And otherwise, I'll follow my gut. And he just had like such great instincts. So we were always shooting with an A cam and a B cam. So a lot of times it would be like, the A cam is going to get the shot that I absolutely need. And sometimes I'd tell Joel, like, and then please get this. And other times I would be too busy and be like, A cam needs to do this. And Joel, just do something. Yeah. And he would. And there are a lot of beautiful shots in the film, because he's just a great, very experienced artist.
Just kind of like give me an option, use your judgment, like, just so you have something else that might surprise you or something you didn't think of. And
I mean, just because they were actually like moving at that speed, where it's like every day I had to pick how many things I could micromanage. There'd be like scenes where like I can micromanage the camera, or the actor. Micromanage is probably a better word. Like, come in and give her like a really specific note that might require, let's talk through this. Let's do a second
directly direct
shot. Very directly get in there and direct, you know. So there's a lot of choices where it's like, I don't have time to frame two shots. So I'm going to let the fantastic camera operators do what they have to do.
So let me ask you, you directed, you produced. Did you edited it as well, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Had you edited a film before?
I edited the Nightmare Adorable short that I had done. That was really like that whole thing, which is on YouTube. If you just Google the Nightmare Adorable, mm-hmm. you can check that one out. That was just a real testing ground. I had done a short before this that I'd be putting on YouTube soon called The Narrator, which was a short, weird experimental kind of thing with Phil Amar, who's also a nice guy and a friend I made here in L.A. And I watched the other person. I hired somebody else to edit it, and then I came over and gave notes, and I watched them edit it. And it was like, the program, I think, for a lot of us is like, it's not. I used a Premiere Pro, and it's like it's a relatively straightforward program. And any question you have, you can Google, and there'll be immediately 800 videos of some guy saying, "Hey guys, how to do whatever thing you need to do." So I feel like the technical bar for editing isn't that high for a lot of people to learn a program like Premiere Pro, and then everything else is rhythm and intent. Everything else is about, I know exactly what I want this scene to feel like, and I know exactly, the character, it needs to end on this character's face, and they have to have this emotion, and there has to be this much pause before for the emotion to land. So all that editing stuff goes back to like rhythm.
How
I know if I'm working on something, I can get deep in it and I can kind of become blind to it. How often were you like stopping to run it by or show someone? How often were you like, "Hang on, Sarah, wait, come here. I've seen this scene.
You're a producer on this.
50 times now. I have no opinion on this that's rational anymore. Be a second set of eyes and brain, please."
Yeah, I asked Sarah a decent amount about like specific scenes, if I was wrestling with something or if I was particularly proud of something or if I had a sort of logic question of, I think this is clear, but do you think this is clear? And she was also very patient for the, I'm not going to tell you why, but I'm going to show you this three times and you tell me if you see a problem. And she'd be like, well, what kind of problem am I looking for? Like, the whole point is for me to not tell you. It's just, do you see this thing? And if you don't, it's not a problem.
Well, this is honestly really fantastic. I the next step really is just getting the word out there, right? So that we can get this film to some degree released. I mean, so what can our people who are listening and want to see this movie, what can they do to help you, or what can we do to help you get this shown?
So, yeah, the premiere in Minneapolis was really just a celebration, and honestly having people see it and see how it plays. So then the world of selling an indie film right now is complicated. You can get a film on streaming relatively easy, but then sometimes it's just kind of like, it's on streaming, and it's sort of like you're just sort of sending social media posts, and it's sort of like, it's on Amazon with everything else.
For now, until they Zaslav you away.
until they take it away for some reason. So I definitely want to get a good deal, make a sale, and put it on streaming, but I also want to experiment with having it shown in more theaters like the Parkway and things like that. Yeah. I would love to have more merchandise out in that. So I eventually want to, because it's about a DVD, eventually want to make physical media. So I'm beginning all those steps. So to answer your question, the most helpful thing that people could do right now is, if they're interested, I have a mailing list signed up that I will email people when there is news, and only when there's news. It's not going to be like, here's how I'm feeling today. It's going to be like, hey, we got Dead Media booked in Cincinnati. Go tell all your friends, kind of thing.
And we'll make sure that's in the show notes here so people can go to where to find that, and we'll put that in our post too. And just, I guess, someone out there might be listening and wanting to do this themselves. What advice do you have? Like, final advice for somebody who wants to, this is their dream and you made your dream happen. What would you say they should start doing?
I think it is really important to just know that it is your choice to fight a movie into existence. I think we are trained a lot to sort of wait for permission or wait for a lucky break. And that happens very rarely, I think, for films that somebody stumbles into it. You have to decide and just... You can start small and just make a short film on your phone and with free editing software, all that stuff is out there. But if you really want to make a feature film, the other thing that I would recommend is there's a book from like 2001 called My First Movie, and it's a collection of interviews with various celebrated directors. And there are people from, you know, the UK, people from America, Zoran Mamdani's mom is in there. she's a celebrated filmmaker. And all of these people across all of these ages in different cultures, all of them stories ends up the same of like, I kind of wanted to make a movie. And then I just decided for some reason, obsessively, like I'm possessed. This is the one that I have to do. And I lost my mind and I had to make this movie. And it was amazing how consistent that is. And I think it does just take that decision to be like, damn it, no matter what, I'm going to make this.
Well, fantastic. Joseph Scrimshaw, The Movie's Dead Media. We have had Joseph on our show many a time, so feel free to go back to old episodes and listen to him then. And thank you so much for being on the show, Joseph. We are really hopeful to see Dead Media in theaters soon.
Me too. Thank you all so much for the interview and, of course, for coming to the premiere.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was great. Enjoyed it.
We've been Geeks Without God. You can follow us on Facebook or Blue Sky. You can go to Patreon if that's a thing you want to do and give us some money. We're not going to say no. I'm not going to say no. I'll let you give us money.
I don't even know how we could do that if you go to Patreon and do that. I don't know how we say
like,
no.
Like somehow we put the Minnesota filter in where you try to pay us and we're like, no, we're good. And they're like, no, really, I want you. It's like, well, if you have to. And you can catch us next week. No, probably in 2 weeks.
Yeah, probably.
Unless you're listening to this late. Every 2 weeks, we come at you hot on a Tuesday. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Join us next week when you'll be able to get excited about something else you can't actually watch or do.
We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Need more Geeks Without God? Go to our website, read our blog posts, find us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Geeks Without God. Social media!
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
I got a cameo.